Why is Heritage Radio Network important to you?
HRN is very nostalgic to go into because it's really the only place that you have this really warm, homey experience to watch people get together and talk about the things that really make a difference.
It's really fun when I ask guests, do you want to be on Heritage? And they're like, at Roberta's? Yes, 100%.
I believe that we all are really trying to bring people together.
I think getting more people excited about good, local, well-crafted food and away from big ag and tasteless commodity food is so important.
It's kind of an honor to be sitting there with so many, in a space where so many other people have sat.
Join HRN's vibrant community of thoughtful eaters. Become a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hello, hello, Heritage Radio Network listeners tuning in from 165 countries around the world, about 1 million listens a month. And today I'm really hoping that they're all listening to this very auspicious episode of Tech Bites. This is the last episode of 2019. Today is December 17th, 2019. It is also the last episode of Tech Bites of the decade. And as we do traditionally, we are going to look ahead to the next year and the next decade. And looking ahead to the next year is good. Looking ahead to the next decade requires a little bit more heavy lifting. So we brought back one of our favorite guests, who is a little bit of a food oracle, I think, because she has been embedded in reporting on food for 2 decades, going into decade 3.
Maybe we're going into decade 3 now.
Woo! Very, very much an expert. Kate Crater, food editor of Bloomberg Pursuits.
This is auspicious for me because Tech Bites is one of my favorite podcasts, so I feel very excited right now.
You were on in the first year, which was 2015. We went on the air in January of 2015. My easy big prediction for next year is we're going to hit episode 200.
Woo!
Probably sometime in February, I think.
I think you're probably right.
Thank you. That is the voice of Mission Control. That is Matt, our studio manager and the engineer of Tech Bites. Matt, will you be here for episode 200?
I think that will also be true. I love dealing in uncertainties.
Yes, we should have brought the magic eight ball.
Yeah.
Oh, that would have been a good one. Anyway, it's important to, you know, I think when you look ahead, you need to have some history of what works and what doesn't. And Kate has a really great, not just finger on the pulse of what's happening nationally and internationally, but she's seen a lot of the trends come and go, and the food world and the tech world is very cyclical, just like everything else, just like fashion. We see trends with maybe a little bit of a tweak and they go through. So she's a great, great person to have to talk about this. And I would love to start with your year-end review, one of your year-end articles, and see how far that's going to push into the next year. Your year-end was Washington is the most exciting food city in America, and that's Washington, D.C.
It is Washington, D.C.
So that's right now.
Right this moment.
Is that going to last for the next 2 weeks and carry into 2020?
I think I would safely bet on that. I mean, I think I'm a native New Yorker, and I will root for New York every day of the week. And certainly, as you know, L.A. has been getting so much heat. I mean, like, every day it's crazy. It's like they're
people from New York are moving to LA.
Oh my God.
That's how exciting it is.
It's like they're giving away those fried chicken sandwiches on a daily basis. So I see you, LA, but I feel like Washington, D.C., for so many reasons, has it going on. And it's not just the food. I mean, the food's very good. I do think if we're talking purely, like, if you go like head to head on the quality of food, I think New York wins. But just in terms of everything that D.C. has going on, from the activist chef hotbed, there's a new place called Immigrant Food that opened up a block away from the White House that is setting up as a meeting place for NGOs when they're not there. And then, of course, like Jose Andreas is saving the world almost single-handedly. And it's also been just this fantastic, it's a place for fast casual concepts especially. It's a great incubator. So Sweetgreen, little company called Sweetgreen, got its start there, and a bunch of others, Kava and Pizza. And it's because it's got a remarkably high rate of highly educated people who earn a lot of money. Because I work at Bloomberg, I can tell you, like, five of the top earning neighborhoods are situated around the DMV. And so it means that there's a lot of people who are working, who are interested in stories and want to hear, like, what's going on, want to experience it. You know, here in New York, not everybody has a minute to go check out something new. And in D.C., they will do it.
In life, over the past few years, the political climate has... And it doesn't matter what side of the coin you're on, mm-hmm. you know, how you look at it, but the political climate and the news has been a huge catalyst for people becoming emotional and excited and wanting to get involved in things socially. People are involved, they're volunteering, they're protesting, they're supporting different things, they're creating groups, they're coming together, there's a lot of community organization. What you're talking about in D.C., is that the culinary version of that, do you think?
Yeah, there's certainly, I mean, I'm sure it's got a lot to do with the fact that the most polarizing person in the whole world is lives in Washington, D.C. right now, and people are right there and want to act out against him. And I think also maybe everybody hears the news everywhere now, but right there you really see it, and it's a city of immigrants. You know, they have like 170 different ethnic groups and races there populating and serving delicious food. And so people, I think people can relate to it in a way that you can't always relate to it. Mind you, like in Queens is fantastic. And LA has terrific ethnic food, and so does Houston. So you can interact. It's not like D.C. is the only place, but it's more immediate in D.C. It's not that big of a city, so it's easy to get around. And again, I can't say how much it seems like D.C. is open-minded and ready to experience things. And whereas in L.A. it's too far. In New York, we don't have any time. There's a bunch of things. In Houston, you have to get in your car. There's like a million reasons why.
Chicago, it's too cold to go outside.
Chicago, it's too cold to go outside. Yep.
At least right now. So you have it as one of your last stories of the year, saying it is the restaurant food city of the moment. How long does something like that sustain itself? Does it now, I mean, because you're also usually an early predictor. And in some ways, it's an interesting question. Are you an early predictor? Are you so good at it that you can make predictions come true also?
Oh, Jen, keep talking.
How long does Washington stay on top? Do they stay on top through the end of the year? Is there a shift? Is it that energy still building?
Four more years.
Stop it right now.
That of voice Heritage I'm Radio. Of Heritage Radio and Tech Bites, right?
Natch.
Well, I think, you know, by its nature, when you make this kind of call, you can't come back and say, like, Washington, D.C. is still the top food city. It's my job to say, like, Indianapolis is the new food city. Like, if I'm lucky enough to be sitting here next year, I doubt I will be saying Washington, D.C. in terms of predictions. But I will say, you know, everything that's made D.C. such a strong food city right now is going to stay in play, whereas New York... there's no sign. I mean, like, what's fighting against New York is just the crazy high expenses all around.
Real estate.
Real estate's crazy, but also minimum wage, doing business. There's so much red tape here. Try, like, talk to any chef about getting Con Ed to do something. Like, just the cost and the headaches and the work of doing business in New York is much harder than it is almost anywhere else. So, you know, like, LA really is rising up. So many talented chefs are going there. But the trend, that I really believe in that's going through to 2020 is autobiographical chefs. And that's chefs because being authentic has become such a hot issue. You know, you have to be so tricky you have to be so careful to say, like, my food's authentic. And what does that even mean? You know,
authentic to what?
Authentic to where? You know, mm-hmm. like if you're from Guatemala and you come here and cook and you're not using ingredients from Guatemala, is your food authentic?
And
is it from
when? To when? You know, Guatemala in what decade?
Right.
Well, things change a lot.
500%. You know, so I think if you shift away from even trying to hold on to that, like, red hot sword that people are trying to like use, and instead your food's autobiographical, then you're sort
authentic
of
to you.
Authentic to you. And so you can call out some fantastic Benihana sauce, you know, that you grew up with, or you can
tell in a pocket.
That will be part when you do your restaurant, Jen. There you go. But I think, you know, I think it's telling your own story, and then you are doing the food that you know. You're acclimating it in the way that you believe in through all these different, all you know.
Do you think that the combination of, you know, cultural appropriation is one thing that we're very sensitive about right now and attuned to? Instagram and social media has also really given rise to looking at and appreciating the value of the individual, mm-hmm. the individual person's point of view, the influencer, what I'm doing right now. Is it now time for that very personal point of view where, you know, that's what people are looking for, which sets you apart versus just I'm doing Oaxacan cuisine or I'm doing French cooking or Tuscan cooking?
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, Instagram's tricky because it's such a fake version of you, or it's almost always, it's...
What? Instagram is fake?
No, it's such a, I mean, it's not untrustworthy.
Photoshopped?
Why don't we say it's an untrustworthy version of, you know, whoever's behind the account. So I think that, yeah, cultural appropriation is such an issue right now. And so if you just say, this is my food and this is what I'm proudly cooking because I'm vegan, because I grew up in a food court, because, you know, my father came from Jamaica and my mother came from Ireland and this is what I cook now. Like, it's really... it's exciting. Although I will say this in the theme of like sitting here in a year and saying what we're excited about, I also feel like it's a trend that can go overboard and be badly used very quickly.
Any trend that doesn't run the risk of going overboard and being badly used? Well, I mean, that's called jumping the shark, isn't
like
it? Essentially,
like fashion, I would call it the classics. Like find me a good classic French bistro, and that's forever, right?
True. Is that a trend, or is that?
Well, it seems like a trend now because French food had gone away, like it'd been totally subsumed by Italian trattorias, right? And then like Frenchette, Le Cucu Frenchette, a couple places now, Pastis came back, and now we can be like, yay, French food. But I think it does sometimes sort of quietly. It's so classy. It quietly sits where it is and lets other cuisines shout, and then you see it again.
It's always there.
It's always there.
It's always there. It's nice. It has been for hundreds of years.
Truth.
So what types of things do you see that are maybe building now, that are maybe headlines or popping up or top of mind, but they're not really a full-blown trend, or they're not a trend that's fully articulated to become just like a part of day-to-day life or a part of the consideration, something that's going to build now, next year, next couple years?
Well, you know, this is something that I think is interesting that I would love to discuss with you because you are uniquely situated to talk about it. But I wonder if there is going to be a rise in analog. Like everything, when you make reservations now, it's so highly automated. It's almost impossible to make a reservation that doesn't involve a lot of, you know, maybe not a lot, but how often do you make a reservation that's not on your phone or that's not on a computer? And I think some places are going to catch up because there's such a need for personalization, or there's such a desire for personalization now. And so you can't have, like, you can't just have a stupid Instagram account that features some like crazy cake. You have to tell a story about it. You know, like if you have like rainbow bagel, shame on you. You have to be like, this is why this is important to me. And likewise, I think personalization has become important to chefs, like whether they write a note, whether they know it's your anniversary and they write you a note or whatever it is. And I think in that way, as some companies like Resy and OpenTable strive to make it a personalized experience, it's other companies are catching up to them. And if everywhere you go, you're like faced with some kind of a kiosk thing that ostensibly personalizes for you, where do you go from there? But back to analog.
I do think analog 100%. Interestingly, just as a side note, personalization is one of the trends that the food tech community is looking at, and it's like personalization of your vitamins or your things and that kind of stuff. We had a guest on earlier this year who talked about meshing together the combination of personal information from data devices that you wear, and then combining that into something that would then tell you what to eat or make food for you, or, you know, you're vitamin D deficient right now, you need to have some dairy and go out into the sun, and, you know, you need some iron, so have that add beets to your salad. So hyper personalization in that sense. I wonder if, because people are so used to, and increasingly so, the ease of technology for accessing and acquiring things, if the gateway into the restaurant or the food experience will remain automated, and increasingly so, but when you cross the threshold into the place, then it becomes extremely analog.
Well, it also depends on the experience that you're going for, right? Because mm-hmm. some places clearly are not going, are like analog is going to be prehistoric for them if it's not already. But I think exactly as you say, there's a certain level of restaurant. It doesn't even have to be like the finest of fine dining. It doesn't have to be Cezanne in San Francisco or Le Bernardin, you know, here in New York. But even on a level like kind of lower from that, maybe like Danny Meyer restaurants, for instance, like Union Square Cafe, whether that's going to be a place where, I mean, especially maybe Danny Meyer, who's, you know, king of hospitality, as they say, that's a place where you feel a personalization, oh, like a human
person.
Personalization. Yeah. Exactly.
It's interesting in that years ago when the first Momofuku restaurant started to open, they never took reservations. Everything was automated. You called the restaurant phone number, you got a recording, and it was you could never find a way to talk to a person.
Do they even have a phone number? I feel like I recall
calling and then getting a loop. Like, you couldn't even call to ask how long the wait was.
I mean,
you
know, famously.
Famously, no people, no access, no way to get to a person. Does analog mean your first experience is a person where you could make a phone call and you could talk to a person, or you walked up to a place and there was a person there to assist you?
Wouldn't that be amazing if a Dave Chang Momofuku restaurant was the one who answered the phone and was like, when would you like your bosom?
Yes. Hello? Welcome to Momofuku land.
Because, no, you're right. There are certainly, they weren't the very first, but they definitely like rang a lot of bells by you had to book for bosoms, et cetera, online. And even like Dave Chang's mom couldn't get in.
It was all.
Yeah.
And the system was built so they couldn't break into it. So right. They couldn't help people jump
right.
the line.
Right.
Well, there's what you talked about earlier about the economics of restaurants being so extreme and high right now. There's a piece of the automation that makes it more economically viable because people are expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think that's going away. But you asked me like to think about what my predictions were. And mine is, you know, if you look at concerts, more people are trying to sequester your phones during concerts using Faraday cages or other things. I don't think that's hit restaurants yet. And I feel like there's maybe going to be this like counter movement where they're like, no, we're giving you this experience. We will force you to put your phone away and only be here.
I mean, restaurants flirt with that idea a lot, and a couple places actually do it. But the counter argument to that is that it is free advertising for them a lot of times. And so if someone comes in and takes a picture and then posts it, and it acts in the same way that Jen was just saying, that if you're saving money by not having too many people answering phones, you're likewise saving money on PR when you have your customers out there being like, look at this pasta, blew my mind, whatever, you know.
But being one of the only places that restricts that access also gets you the PR.
It gets you some PR, but it's also a control issue. Like, at some point, I mean, it depends on, like, how hard it is to grab a phone out of, like, your hot hand, you know? Like,
at some point, if that becomes like a hostile takeover, that's an issue. But it's I think there's something. It will be interesting to see what happens with Instagram in 2020, because certainly chefs are sick of the influencers, and there are people who have made a lot of demands on chefs, like time on restaurants, and attention.
They're also challenged by the timing of service when people are. I mean, some people just take a picture. Some people are on their phone. Some people set up elaborate things and take pictures, and the food hits the table. And I mean, we've read all the articles and heard the stories about, and the food gets cold, and then they have to, or it's taking longer, and it backs everything up. So there's also this extra extraneous time element in terms of the diner's experience that the kitchen and the restaurant and the servers have to manage, with like the unpredictability of that, which... You know, one complaint that I've heard about that is that takes a restaurant's ability away to sort of provide the best dining experience, because it's like stuttering and stopping, and food is cold when people eat it because they spend so much time taking pictures.
But I've heard some very intelligent people come through the studio who have like thought through their method of dealing with influencers, which seems to be grouping them, like herding them towards specific days and specific events, and starting, like, I think that in the next decade, restaurants...
So taking them out of the Gen Pop dining environment.
Restaurants are going to stop getting led around by influencers, and we'll start just, like, herding them where they want them to be, and manipulating their environment more for them, and it's going to become less of a problem, I think, for them. They're going to get smarter about it, basically.
I think that is seems like an answer that's like just sitting there in plain sight, right? You know, that you're like Wednesday night from 5 to 7 Instagram special.
Yeah.
Like that makes a lot of sense.
At 6:05, no phones allowed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might be something that people would certainly have an opinion about it. You'd certainly get a lot of play. And then there would be people who really liked it. It's the same way, you know, in an odd way, books have become more popular. People want paper. People like paper. And I do think that concerts and experiences are more popular because people want the experience, the actual analog real life thing, to go where the people are. Maybe is 2020 in the coming decade when chefs and restaurant people sort of like take back their restaurants and sort of run things more in a way that they want to, authentic to them, their cuisine, maybe putting a control on what type of technology is happening in their dining rooms.
It's so much like it sounds ridiculous, but it blows my mind to think that you know, restaurants that like phones and like pictures and restaurants would become like relatively obsolete. Like it's really hard for me to see that situation.
Interesting, but you would write about it if a restaurant did it.
I would write about it if a restaurant did it. I would. I mean, the thing is, there's a lot, like, this is like not a conversation or a road we need to walk down now, but it's also a much more, it's very complicated dance now too, because some of the people who are influencers are not, you know, food journalism is paid so much, has disappeared so much, and there's so few like paying jobs in the food world that some people, it'll be interesting to see how that works, given how much the relationship between food writers and restaurants is changing on like a daily basis.
Writing also fundamental,
right?
Maybe both at its peak and a dying art in some ways.
Yeah,
to get beyond a couple characters in a post on social media.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting. I do like Matt. That's quite a cool thing to think about, you know, that like they're certain that they get sequestered. That sounds very ominous. Oh my gosh.
Uh-oh. I mean, not when you hear about how fucking annoying some of these influencers are to the chefs who are
trying to do their job.
Yeah.
I am not representing for influencers right now. No. It's just fascinating.
Not a part of the 2020 platform. But what is a part of the 2020 platform is Heritage Radio Network going into our second decade. We celebrated our 10th anniversary this year. We're hoping for another 10 more. And in order for us to do that, we need help from members and listeners like you. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
You listen to Heritage Radio Network because, let's face it, you have really good taste. You care about where your food comes from, who made it, and its impact on the planet. Whether you're looking for an inspiring interview with your favorite celebrity chef, the latest on Dave Arnold's Spinzall, or if you want to get down and dirty with some agricultural policy, we've got you covered. 10 years in and 13,000 episodes later, HRN continues to be the go-to media outlet for thoughtful eaters like you. And we never could have done it without the support of our listeners. Help Food Radio continue in the future and help us raise enough funds for the year to come. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today. And since you've got such good taste, we have some very cool member gifts for you to choose from. Thanks for listening and for being a part of the HRN community.
Well, if you're just joining us and you're wondering what the hell you clicked on, this is Tech Bites, the weekly show on the Heritage Radio Network, where we talk to influencers and innovators in the food tech space. And today we have our last episode of the year of 2019, and we also have our last episode of the decade. Woo-hoo! Very big stuff. Woo! And I feel like we should be drinking champagne and have like party hats and poppers.
I have a champagne bottle size of Miller High Life here, the champagne of beers. Would you like that?
Well, we are Roberta's Pizza. That's probably appropriate.
And I think you also just need the sensation of popping,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
If you hear the pop, that's
exactly.
That's the party sound.
That's the party.
Oh, man. I should have the pop, like a champagne cork pop on the soundboard.
You
goals,
should.
Goals
I feel like that will happen in
2020. 2020 goals, resolution, sound effects. Sound effects for Tech Bites. With us today to take a look forward at 2020 and the coming decade, we have Kate Crater, who is the food editor at Bloomberg Pursuits. If you want to follow her in real life, she is on Instagram. She has a great feed, at kcrater. And if you want to follow Bloomberg Pursuits, that's at Bloomberg Pursuits. She has some really great year-end wrap-up stories. We were talking about D.C. being the food city of the moment, which will probably coast them through 2020. There's also, I mean, if you really want to have some FOMO about last year and try and, you know, check some boxes before you get to that New Year's Eve cocktail party, she also has a great dishes you should have eaten in 2019 and some spirits and things like that. So it's a good primer to get you informed about the big hits from last year. What do you have on tap that you can share with us for 2020? What are some of your stories that you're chomping at the bit to get out of the gate?
That is a great question. One of them, there's a couple things that I'm excited about. One thing that Bloomberg is doing is launching a new green platform. So look out for more stories about eco-minded businesses and food and the people behind them. And we want to get like beyond the straw. Like, we don't just want to talk about a straw, how a straw can save the world. That story
burgers.
Has been told. But yeah, no,
plant-based
I feel like
everything.
If we're talking about 2020, it's the moment we have to talk about
plant-based everything
and like where that's going and what's happening. So so we picked Ethan Brown, who is the head of who started Beyond Meat. And he is, I'm fascinated by the idea of what is the holy grail for him. Like burgers was clearly clearly sitting on top of the pedestal of what it would be great, what needed to be introduced to get people off of meat. But I heard a rumor that dumpling filling was actually a kind of mission statement for some people, because then you can blanket the world. But I think one thing that they're going hard on is poultry. So
the nugget and the fried chicken and the chicken sandwich
exactly
and the tenders
right. And the tenders, all of it.
I think what they really should be targeting is plant-based CBD. It's going to be huge.
Oh my God, what a genius thing. That's something we just had to do a thing. It's going to come out. It's going to come out in a couple days about the trends we loved and trends we hated. Uh-huh. And I was like, can someone, you know what? I understand the joy of CBD. I understand that it brings like happiness and relief to people and pets and everyone around the world. But I just don't want to see any more like CBD raw cookie dough bites. Like, stop it. Just stop
it. It's almost
it.
Like the pumpkin spice exactly. of wellness. You know?
Oh my God.
It's like,
Jen,
right,
precisely.
Right in October, in the ramp in mm-hmm. to Halloween and Thanksgiving, I love to shop at Trader Joe. It's so fun. Mm-hmm. I walked into the store one day and literally everything was pumpkin spice. Pumpkin spice coffee, soap. They had a pumpkin spice sheet mask for your face, which just to me is just overboard.
Stop it. Stop it right now.
CBD is like the pumpkin spice thing, except it's not going to go away because it's seasonal.
It's not seasonal.
It's not seasonal. Exactly. Because, you know, the season of stress is just all the time.
I mean, I don't want it to disappear. I just want people to use it wisely. You know what I mean?
And just have it take a place on the shelf along with the other functional beverages?
Like CBD popcorn, I'll allow it. You know, there's a lot. There's a lot that I'm good with, but I feel like there's some lines that have to be drawn.
I would be happy if I just didn't have to hear about it as much. Uh-huh.
Well, that's exactly the truth as well.
So what are some of the trends that you're hoping are going to disappear? Because it's always fun to talk about those.
I will be happy. I think there's been, in contrast to the fake meat thing, there is way too much of those, like Fred Flintstone size beef meat situations, you know, like tomahawk chop
the
times
giant
five.
72 ounce or 96 ounce for two people.
Yeah.
This is a thing now? Today,
yes.
2019.
Matt's a vegetarian, so he's not hip to the steakhouse offerings.
Just didn't even know.
Yes. It's like market price, $230, 96 ounce ribeye for two.
Yeah, exactly.
Carved tableside.
I know where it's coming from because entrees are sort of an endangered species now because everybody has, like, everyone does small plates and then everyone wants to do family style because it's fun and convivial.
Except the French bistro.
Entrees live. They
live
forever, ever. But, you know, I understand exactly where these big things of meat are coming from, but they're disgusting. You know, they're disgusting. They're hard to cook. I think chefs need to be smart about serving them.
Is there anything from the far corners of your travels? And I mean, you were in Europe, you're in DC, you're all over. Do you see any small little nuggets of things that are happening that you think might be growing? I mean, it might take a year or two. Anything that really piqued your curiosity?
You know, I was just in, DC really captured my imagination as I wrote about. And I like the accessibility thing. I go back to the autobiographical chef thing and like feeling like a chef is telling you a story when they're cooking, you know, or through their food, which I think is great. Like at this really good place called Emily's, the chef that is, what is it, Yum Yum Sauce from Benihana? He proudly has Yum Yum Sauce on his menu, but he also makes like cacio e pepe with miso, and that's smart. You know, that's really, really smart. So I appreciate that. I appreciate someone who will put like a Swiss cheese on a pizza because they grew up eating fondue and then they were like, let's try this. Let's see what happens. So I feel those are some of the things I'm seeing. I also just came back from Amsterdam and that food scene was very simple. It wasn't like food with too many accents, and that's something I would love to see more of here. I think it's not quite as crazy town as it was in the heyday of like help me with what cuisine had like so many had like millions
Thai.
Of flourishes and dashes. No, it's not so many. It's not like that. It's more like gratuitous like blackberry jam glaze on top of a like this or that. The food there was just infinitely simple. There's also sick bread and butter situation, and I feel very good about the bread that everyone is baking here across the country. But if people want to pay even more attention to butter, I'll be happy about that.
Can I get two dairy, next decade?
Dairy butter or plant-based butter?
Dairy butter. Okay. Although, mind you, the plant-based cheese and dairy situation has gotten much better. It's a very, very good time to be vegan, in my opinion.
Matt, do you concur?
I do concur.
Yay. Yeah.
I cut you off. You were about to say.
Oh, I've got two. I've got a short one and a long one.
Okay.
Short one is Genever. It's going to take over the U.S.
And nice.
Maybe not take over, but it'll be like a thing that people can pronounce. And two, vending machines.
Yes.
On the rise.
Yes.
In the next decade, for sure, because of wages of people working in the restaurant industry and a desire for better product, but an inability to pay more for the product. You're going to, and also just like, familiarity and a feeling of comfort with automation. It's gonna, they're coming.
Well, Kate did a great story about a meat vending machine. Was it last year?
I think it was last year, yeah.
Great, great story. It's wacky. It is a meat vending machine at a butcher shop outside the city, and they have, like, you can get steaks at a vending machine, which is crazy.
Well, the thing is, I think it's a little bit situational, but I agree with you, Matt. Like, I think they've gone from curiosity, you know, a ridiculous, like, look at me, get my cupcake from the vending machine, like, you know, Instagram, and to being something that's really useful. Like in Chicago, there's a company called Farmer's Fridge that has machines now, certainly like all over O'Hare Airport, but also I think in universities and stuff. And I watched a line form at a gate at O'Hare Airport for people to get these salads, which are actually very, very fresh, and look, I tasted them, and the one that I tasted I thought was really good. And I think it's like, I think it can be healthful, it's certainly convenient. But then on the flip side of that, there's, you know, the kind of thing, like I think the meat vending machine that was out in the Catskills, I think they were talking about setting up in New York, but they were going to need like armed security so people wouldn't break into them. So some of it might be self-defeating.
We did have earlier this year an episode with the woman who had the Jar Cafe Anacoli in the West Village, who now has a vending machine company called Fresh Bowls, where it's basically salad in a jar in a vending machine. Same idea, it sounds like, as the Farmer's Fridge. You go, you get a fresh-made salad, it's refrigerated, and then you can bring the jar back and return it to the machine and then get a discount on your next salad. So it's not just convenience, but then also she's very into zero waste and reusing.
That's awesome.
So they piloted the vending machines at WeWork spaces and universities and hospitals and things like that, where people have just totally different, you know, life work hours.
You know, also in that thing of convenience, I think we're going to see more. It's the opposite of the personalization we talked about a couple minutes ago. But there, I think the kiosk automation thing that you see done really well at places like Shake Shack is going to take over more fast food places. I met with Bite Kiosk, and there's a couple ex-units.
We've had them on the show.
Oh, my gosh.
Two years ago.
Really?
Yep.
I think it's really cool. They're working with some cool companies now, like I think By Chloe and Numpang. And so in that way that, you know, if you order something on Amazon and it's like, if you like this, you might like that. Like it recommends like the kind of onion rings you might want on the side of your fried chicken sandwich. And I think that is just, you know, in some ways a sign of intelligent life that you sort of have a slightly more personalized accessibility in some ordering, although that, of course, is going to bring us back to personalization at different kinds of restaurants.
Yes.
But you get both. It makes
sense.
You get
both. You have
both.
It all.
I went into one of the Amazon Go shops the other day down in the financial district, where you download the Amazon Go app, you have a barcode, it connects to your Amazon account, and you basically walk into, it's a convenience store, in essence. And they did have one or two staff people. You basically scan in, you go through the turnstile, you pick up whatever you want from the shelf, and you leave, and it just charges you for what you took, which
is
crazy.
What was that experience like?
Yeah, how did that feel? That's what I want to know. Mm-hmm.
It felt a little futuristic, although what made it not futuristic is that it's just the same convenience store foods that you have. It was like, you know, the pre-made sandwiches, it was all the different drinks, it was you know, microwavable things that we've seen before. So the experience was kind of easy, just go in and go out, and then it all worked as it should have. But I almost wanted the food to be better or something different, or the food itself to be more futuristic. Or at least better, not just, you know, 7-Eleven.
Well, on the flip side of that, some other trends that we're looking at, and I think you'll like one of these especially, is we're seeing a lot of Eastern European cuisine coming up across the country. Steven Starr has a new restaurant in the new Swedish Fotograph Museum called Veronica that I think is going to lean towards like Vienna and Prague and places like that. And then in San Francisco, Ravi Kapoor, who has Liho Liho, has just opened a place called Dear
Aloha.
Called like Dear Elga or Olga or something. But anyway, that goes very towards like Eastern European beer hall, lots of fermented, lots of meat. And I feel excited about that because I love that food.
Sort of progressing from Asia back towards the continent, sort of going through
coming
that.
Coming back to the continent. And then another thing I'm hearing a lot of rumors about, Jen, which I think you'll appreciate, are disco bars, the return of the disco bar. Like I think the kids have heard a lot of house music and they want to hear. It's not like you never hear
it's
disco.
It's the 90s.
But I think it's going to be, it's the 90s. So I think you're going to hear like maybe more offbeat tracks than the 10 that you hear on a daily basis. And they're using like albums as coasters and stuff like that. And maybe even some eco-friendly glitter and some cocktails.
Eco-friendly glitter, sign me up.
I'm in. I would like to make a bulk order for Heritage Radio Network.
Let's do it.
Eco-friendly glitter, it's probably like almost edible then if it's eco-friendly. It's probably made from like corn.
Maybe it is.
Unicorn.
Exactly.
It's just straight unicorn farts.
Exactly.
Drink be at the disco bar if it's retro? This is pre-cosmopolitan.
I think it must be, let's make one up.
White wine spritzers?
Midori sour.
Oh. Midori sour.
That came out of nowhere because I don't think I've ever had one, but
I just think of like green.
As you should.
Right. I'm thinking back to, you know, the photos and, you know, the things that I've seen about Studio 54, which was basically like champagne and.
Yes. Ordering.
We are unfortunately out of time. Which is always sad because there's always so much more to talk about. We have another 10 years to talk about. Kate, do you have any last thoughts that you want to get out before we close this year and the decade and the show? Either something that made a huge impression on you this past decade or something that you're really hoping for or thinking about?
I'm just going to say quickly because I'm relentlessly eco-minded. I think 2020 is going to be the year of seaweed. I think we already saw a lot of it. And I think to go with all the like faux meat and the innovations that we're making in packaging and everything, I think people are going to be eating better and cleaner and it's going to be awesome.
Okay. That sounds very positive. Sounds also very Heritage Radio Network. Matt, do you have any closing thoughts on the decade, the year?
Well, I'll play off that one. I'm going to say, the 2020s, the decade of umami, where more people understand umami divorced from just like meat. But also,
I'm getting a t-shirt.
Hashtag
bumper sticker.
Matt, make that t-shirt.
An anti-prediction. I think, even though I'm very excited about what, like, for instance, the James Beard Foundation is doing with VR, I think that in 2029, we will be talking about VR and AR, especially as it relates to food, but also in general, basically the same way as we were talking about it now, which is like this fringy, interesting thing that does not impact our daily lives. Hot take.
Side note, the James Beard Foundation AR, VR dinner experience that they have right now, it was supposed to end on December 29th, and they've extended it to the end of January. We did a show, was it last week, Matt, was the show?
Yeah, and because of your show, I'm going tomorrow.
It is spectacular. I went and had the experience. It's about an hour long. It's like nothing I've ever experienced before. And I've done virtual reality games, which are fun.
Yep.
I've had a lot of, you know, high-tech, futuristic dining experiences, but I've never had the two together. And that's part of what makes this experience so interesting, because you're simultaneously in the virtual reality world, but you're also consuming food and things, but you're perceiving them as they are in the virtual world. So it's not like you see, you know, an hors d'oeuvre. You see, you know, colors and shapes and things like that. And it's really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. It was really fascinating. I'm very excited about it. I'm very hyped on it. And I also think that it will be largely irrelevant in the next decade.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the prediction, I think we have a lot of technology right now that hasn't quite come together yet. And I think hopefully over the next decade, we'll see these different pieces of technology come together to become more and more functional and more environmental. And what I mean by that is we have some smart technology in the kitchen. We have smart technology on our phones. If you could open your refrigerator and it could tell you what food you had in there, and then something like a Watson could spit out some recipes that you could cook with all the food that you had, you could bring waste down in your kitchen by using what you had versus starting with a recipe where you go out and you buy a bunch of things and maybe you have leftovers, or you open your refrigerator and you stand there for 10 minutes and you have a bunch of disparate items and you're not quite sure what to do with it. If we had technology that helped us sort of inventory the resources we had and then helped us with utilizing all the resources that we have in a functional, delicious way, we would probably need fewer resources and have less waste.
Well, I think food waste, everyone's like so eyes on food waste right now. I think that's a big, I think that that's something that you're going to see definitely more innovation on, whether it's things like that, like the smart fridge, which I think we're very close to anyway. It's also just, but then like you need people to do it. You know, you need people to be like, okay, now I know how to make this carrot top pesto, but I'm going to order a pizza.
Yes. <You know? laughs> But that's okay too. That's okay too.
Right.
That's what makes it interesting for sure. We do have so much technology. It's going to be interesting to see how it develops and then how it comes together and which things stay with us and which things don't. But one thing that we're sure will stay with us is Heritage Radio Network. Tech Bites will be back in January. Tune back in. We will figure out what day the episode 200 will be. Maybe Kate will have you back. We haven't figured out what that's going to be, but I'm feeling like we need
RSVP,
a party. And we need
yes.
that. We need that cork pop sound.
I know.
Maybe disco bar. Maybe we'll do the disco bar show.
Everyone will just have to believe that we've got the edible glitter glowing in our martini glasses.
CBD glitter.
No, stop it.
I want to thank Kate Crater, the food editor of Bloomberg Pursuits, for coming out and closing out the decade with us. Again, you can find her online at Bloomberg Pursuits and on social media at Kate Crater or at Bloomberg Pursuits. You can find Tech Bites on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Simplecast, all of your favorite podcasting platforms. Tech Bites lives at the Heritage Radio Network. We are two repurposed shipping containers at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We are also online at heritageradionetwork.org. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. We are completely member-supported. Make it a resolution to give back next year and maybe start with us.
And cue the popping champagne.
Exactly. I'm Jennifer Liuzzi. This is Tech Bites. Thank you for listening, and best wishes for a delicious new year and decade to all. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Just enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage.
Hi,
thanks for listening.
Sherry Bayer, the host of All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm thrilled to let you know about Host, Summit Plus Social, a new conference for and about the hospitality industry, taking place Monday, January 27th, 2020, at the William Vale in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, New York City. Based on my All in the Industry show, HOST, which stands for Hospitality Operations, Services, and Technology, will bring behind-the-scenes talent in hospitality to the forefront in a live format, featuring guests from some of my most popular episodes, including Drew Nieporant, Rita Jamay, Crystal Mobiyeni, J.J. Johnson, and Jeff Gordonier. Our event will include intimate panels, one-on-one interviews, industry news discussions, curated lunch conversations, and more. Plus, of course, we will have outstanding food and drink throughout the day, including an energizing closing reception. For more information and tickets, please go to allintheindustry.com. And also, please follow us at All Industry on Instagram and Twitter. I hope you will join us in celebrating our dynamic hospitality industry. Many thanks.